Welcome to The Conversation on this Thursday. I'm Chris Vandercook. The catastrophic flooding in Houston, Texas was of a size and scale no one had anticipated, and the city's homeowners will feel the effects for years after the emergency crews have gone home. Disasters like Hurricane Harvey always raise the question of preparedness and remind us that severe flooding can come to areas where residents thought they were safe. The state is working to educate the public about flood insurance, and we asked Carol Chow Beam, National Flood Insurance Program Coordinator for the State Department of Land and Natural Resources, to fill us in.
Probably the people that are most aware of their flood risk is someone who has a mortgage that's in a high risk area, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they believe that they're at risk of flooding.
Well, in Houston, a lot of people who got flooded weren't in high-risk areas, right?
Uh-huh. And that's actually more common than people think. FEMA sees 25% of their claims come in from these areas that are not mapped in a high-risk zone.
Well, what, and we've seen flooding in areas in here in Hawaii, that areas that didn't expect it, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. And it doesn't have to be, the 1% annual chance or the 100-year or that big flood or a named event. We could have, last week we had heavy rains. We see that often.
You think that there are some, well, obviously there are some areas of each island that are more prone than others, and are homeowners in those areas, you think, sufficiently aware of what they're dealing with?
Well, I'd like to think that, the coastal community is aware of their risk. Whether they are protected through flood insurance, that's, a different story.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times folks, only have the insurance because they're mandated to have it as a condition of their mortgage. But once the mortgage is paid off, a lot of times they drop the coverage.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Putting the whole shebang at risk, yeah?
Yeah, the mandatory requirement may go away, but the risk remains, mm-hmm. And understandably, it's an added cost. One has to, look at their financial situation. But the burden of trying to recover from a flood, sometimes you can't. I mean, it's so overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's just say, let's put ourselves in the position of somebody who maybe just bought a home or was just looking to protect their home. What are tools available to them to find out, for instance, how much they're at risk?
Well, I would start with looking at FEMA's flood insurance rate maps. They, identify high-risk areas, but, I will say that they are identifying this 1% annual chance event. So it's a quite large magnitude event.
Mm-hmm.
However, we could see flooding from a smaller event that's not necessarily mapped. And so, you could look at FEMA's maps. You could talk to your county officials to see if they have more localized type of historical data.
Mm-hmm.
The civil defense agencies might have, or the emergency management agencies might have that kind of information. Red Cross might have that kind of information as well.
It sounds as if the information is a certain amount of detective work involved in all this.
There is. But you're putting your life, you've worked so hard, to save up, to buy this home, and I think it's the property owner needs to do, or a prospective buyer should do, their due diligence. And you can't rely, on everything from a realtor. Or you have to take, that initiative and look for the information and attend any kind of, public outreach that they have during, like, hurricane season. They have a lot of events going on. There's one this weekend in Ewa Beach, and, you know, they have a lot of resources out there in one place that, you know, property owners can, and even renters can talk to the different agencies that are out there.
I think that's the key when dealing with a lot of, an issue where there are a great many agencies is getting everything in one place.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a key, but I'm looking online at this flood hazard assessment tool.
Mm-hmm.
And could you kind of walk me through how that works?
Sure. So the tool, you can either search by, you know, your address or your tax map key.
Uh-huh.
And the main layer or information that we're trying to get across is that FEMA flood insurance rate map. So it's not the only source to view these, what we call a FIRM map, the acronym FIRM map. But at DLNR, we've put together a tool that we feel like is user-friendly, and we use a color symbology so that you can really kind of see what the different zones are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
FIRM, the acronym FIRM stands for what?
Flood Insurance Rate Map.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now that you say that, it makes a lot of sense. But it's so you can actually look up where you live and see what kind of shape you're in, and that would be part of the whole
right.
You know, process of,
mm-hmm.
of figuring all this
mm-hmm.
out. Where would you go from there? Suppose I find out that I'm a little bit more at risk than I, a little bit less covered and a little bit more at risk than I.
Yeah,
would
so like
if,
once you look up your property, and if you're in an area that's designated as an A or V zone, so it starts with the letter A or V,
mm-hmm.
as in Victor. That's a high risk zone. So if you don't already, you know, if you don't have a mortgage and are already being mandated to have coverage as a condition of your mortgage,
mm-hmm.
I would talk to your agent, your insurance agent.
That's when you need to just go right to your insurance
yeah,
agent.
Yeah, you know, and talk about what your options are, because you are in a high risk zone. You might not be mandated to buy, but it might be a wise investment.
Yeah, what you're saying is don't, as far as the mandate is, if you can avoid it, if you can manage to pay for it,
mm-hmm.
do so.
Yes.
Carol Tell Beam is the National Flood Insurance Program Coordinator for the State Department of Land and Natural Resources. The 7th Annual Get Ready Eva Beach Emergency Preparedness Fair is this Saturday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Eva Mackay Middle School.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we'll wrestle with some of the questions about free speech. Can opinions be too dangerous to allow on campus? Is violence at protests ever justified? And should protesters be allowed to carry weapons? Three takes on political discord and protest, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Sunday morning at 9, right after Weekend Edition.
We admit it, we want to get closer to you. There's so much happening at HPR these days. Great new programs, unique local coverage from our award-winning news team, and all sorts of ways we can work together to make life in our islands even better. We'd like to tell you more about HPR and would love to add you to our email list. Please sign up at hawaiipublicradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you, and with your email, you'll be hearing more from us soon.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the social upheaval that got us where we are today. But first, your quiz.
Unihoa,
After talking to gold medalist Christy Yamaguchi yesterday, we were reminded that there are many island athletes who've left their mark in the Olympic record books. Starting with the 1912 games in Stockholm when Duke Kahanamoku won the 100-meter freestyle, taking home the gold. Since then, Hawaii has been well represented in swimming, wrestling, the decathlon, and many other sports, including judo. Historically, in 1908, Japanese immigrants started the Shobukan Judo Club. Practice of the martial art flourished so that by 1975, judo was adopted into the statewide sports curriculum. For today's quiz, we're looking back at an Olympian who started judo at the age of 7, competed at Pearl City High School, continued training at Tokai University, and eventually competed in the 1988 Summer Games, where he placed among the best. Do you know who we're talking about? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the name of this judoka Olympian. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, this is Sully Erna from Godsmack, and you're tuned to The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The territory of Hawaii in the first half of the past century was in some ways a successful social experiment, with people from Asia, the Pacific, and the mainland living in relative harmony. But it was at the same time a rigidly stratified society, with the so-called Big Five business giants firmly in control, propped up by laborers who had to take what they could get. That all changed in the years after the Second World War, when organized labor got a foothold in Hawaii and never let go. HPR's Kuave Hiraishi looks back with us at the popular movement that upended Hawaii society. Hi, Kuave.
Aloha, Chris.
Thanks for coming in.
Yes, and happy belated Labor Day.
That's right.
I was looking into sort of one of the many strikes that happened in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. This particular one began on Labor Day in 1946. And it was the first strike to ever shut down the sugar industry here in Hawaii. So we're talking 33 of the 34 plantations across the island states are just all the workers will not come to work, and they could not do anything about it.
What a shockwave that sent, huh?
It was. It's looked upon as the most the sort of best organized strike, or the first organized strike, highly organized strike, that was successful in doing exactly that. Because prior to this, all the strikes were sort of done by particular ethnic groups,
right,
in sort of these silos. So the Japanese would organize. But when the Japanese organized on a plantation, what the plantation owners would do was go and pay the Portuguese or the Filipino more money to go and do what the Japanese. So they play them
off against each other.
Exactly. And it was actually one of the strategies. They don't talk about it too much, but it was one of the strategies of the plantation owners to make sure that they wouldn't get along so that they could still be producing sugar.
Well, to coordinate a strike like the one you're describing, it takes communication.
And
trust. You know,
exactly.
Which are the things that frequently keep labor movements from getting off the ground. You know, you sow the seeds of distrust among people, aggravated by ethnic tensions, right?
Exactly. Historic ethnic tensions. And that was something that they were very aware of. In fact, an interesting fact about this particular strike was that there was word going around on the plantations that the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, was trying to get people organized. Mm-hmm. So what the plantation owners began to do was go to the Philippines, bring in 6,000 laborers with the idea that these laborers would not would not side with the union because they just got here. They don't know who to trust, but mm-hmm. they can trust the folks that just brought them there.
Mm-hmm.
But what the ILWU did was they had workers, cooks, that were working on the ships that were bringing over the Filipinos.
Oh.
And so what they did was they recruited the Filipinos. So by the time that everyone landed in Honolulu or wherever they were going to be, they had new union members.
Uh-huh.
And the Filipinos joined in this strike because they were able to get them before they got here.
So that's really what it is, especially, you know, you always wonder how that first labor action gets going.
You right.
know, that it's, once there's a pattern, it's another thing. But that very first time that you get to, you know, you say, I'm not going to work, you have to trust that the other parties don't go to work either.
Right. And this was a 79-day strike.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was interesting to – so who I spoke to for this was William Pewitt. He's a professor over at the Center for Labor and Education and Research at UH West Oahu. And what he was telling me was that during these strikes, these people, they're not getting paid, but they're also not sitting around waiting for something to happen.
Mm-hmm.
They actually are working every day to get the strike done with or keep the morale boosted. So they would have a morale committee, they'd have a strike negotiation committee.
Mm-hmm.
And the committee that was really interesting was the bumming committee. So the bumming committee's job was to go to mom-and-pop stores or wherever they could sort of solicit donations for food for folks who didn't have money saved up
uh-huh.
and make sure that people were being fed and people could get the necessities
yeah.
that they needed for this. I mean, it's almost 79 days, almost 3 months, right?
Yeah. One of the remarkable things about a strike like that is that most of the strikers are people who are basically at subsistence level.
Exactly.
They can barely go 2 weeks without that paycheck, right?
Exactly. And what they were, so the one of the key issues here, like all the other strikes, was better pay, better living conditions. But one thing that did change on account of this strike was the Percocet system. So not like the drug, but we're talking about the long form for the word perks. So
uh-huh.
these are benefits. And prior to this, things like housing and medical were given as favors by the plantation owners to the workers. So if there was ever, it was never a right. So if there was ever some word getting around that you were taking part in a, you know, in a strike, or you were talking to the guy who was organizing a strike,
you weren't going to get those favors.
You could be moved to the crappiest shack on the on the plantation, and you'd have to live with that because you need someplace to stay. So after this strike, that system, the Percocet system, was abolished, and things like housing and medical were seen. I think what they did initially was they were given the cash equivalent to go out and pay for housing or whatnot, but eventually these things became labor rights for our workers.
So many people in Hawaii are beneficiaries of what happened in the late 1940s. Do you think the latest generations to come along are really aware of that history?
I think in Hawaii we are, but I think we aren't aware of the conditions, the squalid working conditions, and what had to be done to
yeah.
get what we have right now.
We tend to pretty up our history, don't we?
We do, but the rise of the union from that point on, really, like you said, they got a stronghold on the industry. Right now, we are at nearly 20% of the workers in Hawaii are represented by a union, and that's the second highest union rate in the nation, behind New York.
Well, that's some valuable background, Kuvei. Thanks very much.
Yes, thank you.
Kuvei Hiraishi is HPR's General Assignment Reporter.
Aloha, this is Dr. Carl Hart from Columbia University. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Where will Hawaii's lawmakers be when the music stops next year? The dance has already begun in the game of musical chairs that always gets underway when a high-profile office holder signals the intention to vacate one office to seek another, as Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa has done in announcing her gubernatorial ambitions. Civil Beat political and opinion editor Chad Blair is looking ahead to the Democratic primaries next August, because that's where the real action is, and he offers his Akamai guide to the 2018 elections. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Pretty good. This story has is ripe with detail, for one thing, isn't it?
I've named names. I've shamelessly dropped names, according to talking to a lot of people about who the likely challengers, contenders are for a variety of offices. Because, you know, Hanabusa is leaving Congress again, I should add. Remember, not all that long ago, she ran for the U.S. Senate trying to knock Brian Schatz off. And that, of course, sent Mark Takai to Congress, albeit only for a short time, sadly. But the same thing is happening this year, but early. You know, we're still not quite a year out from the primary, and already we're seeing people lining up for key races.
You find out at times like this what people's ambitions are, don't you?
You sure do. And I think one of the things about Hanabusa that may hurt her is, well, wait a minute. You know, you were in Congress. Then you ran for the Senate. You lost. Then you went back to Congress. Now you're looking at running for governor. I mean,
Don't forget Hart.
Oh, don't forget. Yeah, exactly. All the things that she's done. She's been on a number of boards. On the other hand, it does reflect on the Congresswoman's vast experience, her drive, and there may be people inspired by a candidacy for governor. Governor David Ige, as we all know, his poll numbers have been low, and there is some question as to whether he will be reelected. Remember, he's the guy that knocked off incumbent Neil Abercrombie just 3 years ago, and nobody saw that one coming.
His knocking off of the incumbent was unprecedented in Democratic politics in Hawaii, wasn't it?
It was, and I think actually nationally it was rated as the rare time that in a primary, I believe it was the worst defeat, something like 30 percentage points. It was really astounding. So not only Hawaii history, but nationally when it comes to a governor's race.
A sitting governor in his own party's primary. But that sort of shows you, it shows you a lot of things. It shows you the kind of ambition that's out there, but also that it isn't necessarily that the party doesn't move in anything resembling lockstep. At times like this, it's every man and woman for themselves, right?
It is, and I think there's always been a bit of a myth that the higher-ups control who's going to run for what. In fact, there's been a number of intra-party challenges, particularly for governor. We could name, Tom Gill against Jack Burns and a number down the line. And so I don't think that's anything that you could control. It's not like a figure like Dan Inouye was controlling all the strings. He, by the way, didn't want Abercrombie to leave Congress to run for governor, but he did anyway and got elected. So there's really a wide open seat here. I think we're looking at Hanabusa versus Ige. I don't imagine any other brand name candidates, with the exception of the mayor of Kauai, Bernard Carvalho. He's term limited. There's definitely been talk that he wants to run for governor. Now that it's Hanabusa versus Ige, we'll see. Could he be a spoiler? Could he maybe get enough votes to get past him in the primary? That's one of the big questions.
Does Hanabusa have to resign to run for governor?
No, she does not. I checked with the elections office, and remember, Abercrombie did. He actually stepped down, I think it was in April of 2010, the election year, and you know what happened then? Charles DeJoux,
to his eternal regret, stepped down.
Yes,
right?
I think so. Charles DeJoux, a Republican, went to Congress for 7 or 8 months. It didn't last very long. Hanabusa, of course, would get back in, get in for the two-year term, and more. But I did check with her campaign. She is not planning on doing that. So that means no special election, but there will still be a primary, obviously, and a general election contest for the, as we call it, the CD1, right? Congressional District 1, or First Congressional District.
Who do you think's going for that one?
A lot of people. Donna Mercado Kim, she finished second to Mark Takai, way back in the pack, but ahead of all the other people by a large margin. She said she is thinking about it. She's got some family considerations. She's a state senator, of course. I think the name that's caught a lot of people by surprise is Doug Chin, our attorney general, who, to my knowledge, has never run for office, but is extremely high profile. given that he seems to sue the Trump administration just about every other month.
Yeah.
Yeah, including yesterday over the Dreamers Act. And you know, I think he is really, his profile is quite elevated. And there's talk that he might be a very strong contender. Kaniela Ng, the representative from Maui, is also a possibility.
With Doug Chen, Chad, is that something he's saying or is it something that's being said about him?
He didn't return my call, wisely so, probably, but it has been said by numerous people. His name came up more than anybody else's from the people that I talked to for the congressional seat. There's even a chance, you know, chance that Sui does end up resigning and running for Maui mayor. Well, then there's a line of succession. Ron Cochi and Scott Sankey, the president and speaker, say they don't want the job. We'll see if that holds. But if that's the case, guess who's next in line? The Constitution says the Attorney General. But Doug Chen doesn't appear to want to be LG. Everyone I talked to a man and woman, said Congress seems to be where he's headed. Again, not confirmed from the source himself, though.
Well, I think we probably are not done talking about this, Chad.
Chris, it's only September of 2017, and it's already begun. I can't wait.
I know. I'm worn out already. Thanks a lot, Chad. We'll be in touch.
Anytime.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair. This has been a week of diplomatic consultations and confrontation across the Asia-Pacific when it comes to North Korea. That follows Sunday's nuclear test, which U.S. officials say was 10 times the size of the nuclear explosion at Hiroshima, Japan. North Korea says it was a hydrogen bomb. In just a minute, we'll get a look at the situation in Guam on the ground from Jefferson Cronin of KPRG, Public Radio Guam. But first, our news director, HPR's Bill Dorman, joins us to talk about those diplomatic meetings in the region. And a lot of this, they're still talking about economic sanctions. Yeah, Bill?
Aloha, Chris. Yeah, they sure are. You know, right after that test on Monday, Labor Day here in the U.S., U.N. Security Council held an emergency meeting talking about ratcheting up sanctions. This would be the eighth set of sanctions since North Korea started with its first nuclear test back in 2006. Mm-hmm. Critics, you know, say they haven't really accomplished a lot. Clearly, they have not prevented North Korea from progressing along its course.
Might they even be playing into North Korea's hands? We talked to an expert a couple of weeks ago on the show who said essentially that the more beleaguered he gets, the premier gets, the more he can sort of keep his people focusing, keep the people's focus away from other problems in North Korea.
Well, and it's, you bring up a good point. A lot of this is a matter of degree. You know, in terms of sanctions, there's always the question of, oh, well, what more can you do? Now, mm-hmm. the focus right now is oil imports to mm-hmm. North Korea. That would be the next big item. That's primarily China, Russia secondarily to that. Right now, the Russia, Vladimir Putin, has said this week, well, not sanctions alone will not be enough. They will not work. But there's some indication that the Chinese now, China's foreign minister just this morning actually said China agrees the UN Security Council should make a further response by taking necessary measures. Now, that's sort of vague enough
diplomacy. Language.
Right. But the question of how much is that going to be on oil? There are a couple of other things. North Korea exports textiles. That's now their leading export now that the coal exports have been cracked down because of past UN sanctions.
Yeah.
And also North Koreans working overseas and sending hard currency back. Tens of thousands of North Koreans around the world do this. The top two host countries for these, though, about 20,000 in China and about 20,000 in Russia.
We seem to be seeing a kind of a rare unity among countries like Russia, China, and the U.S., all of them operating against North Korea.
Well, and, you know, how to do that.
They're kind of painting themselves into a corner, it would seem.
Well, that it comes down to that question of execution, of how do you do this, even if it's a shared goal in terms of pressuring Pyongyang.
Yeah.
How exactly does that work at this point, and what are the levers at the disposal of the international community?
Yeah.
And that's what's really going around. It's interesting. The UN Security Council, of course, is the center of sanctions, but there are also these regional aspects to this as well. And just as timing would have this, a couple of international meetings this week, the BRICS summit, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, that was this past Monday, Tuesday, hosted by President Xi Jinping in China. And mm-hmm. the word was that Xi Jinping was furious that North Korea sort of upstaged his event by having a nuclear test. This week, Eastern Economic Forum's been going on in Russia, in Vladivostok, which if you look on a map, Vladivostok is less than 90 miles from the North Korean border.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, that's where South Korea's president, Japan's prime minister, had talks there as well. So, again, we'll see what comes back to the UN Security Council, but this is certainly, in terms of the region itself, something that's of high concern. South Korea's prime minister just today saying that they expect another missile test as soon as Saturday from
North Korea. Well, you know, Bill, it's really valuable to look at this from the Asia side, and most of us don't get the opportunity to do that. So that really fills in a lot of gaps. Thank you.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director, spent more than 10 years reporting from Asia. Every weekday, he writes and produces the Asia Minute for HPR. You have to wonder what it's like to live on Guam these days, with your island home the subject of international spear rattling, with nukes taking the place of spears. As North Korea continues to, in UN Ambassador Nikki Haley's words, beg for war, and Guam sits in the supposed crosshairs, we're asking our Guam Public Radio colleague Jefferson Cronin what the mood is there. Hi, Jefferson. Thanks for talking with us.
Hey, my pleasure.
I'm assuming that part of dealing with this is keeping your sense of humor back there on Guam, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're good at that anyway, but you really have to because if you don't, it just the weight of it will just, you know, it's not healthy, you know?
Well, it becomes kind of a barrage. Does it get a lot of play in local news media there?
Well, to some extent. I mean, we keep an eye on it, you know, but we're so used to it. I mean, the threats are they're pretty regular and have been for a while, and so we're kind of used to it. Of course, all this testing going on and all that kind of thing makes us pay even more attention, but we're not really preoccupied with it, I don't think. We've gotten kind of philosophical about it, I think, and although there are people, of course, who are rattled by it, but I think most of us have a pretty even attitude about it. I think we're more worried about the economic impact at this point than anything else.
Well, for one thing, being preoccupied wouldn't do a lot of good, would it?
Well, no, of course not. I mean, we have absolutely no control over any of it, you know.
Well,
excuse me?
No, go ahead, Jefferson. Sorry.
Oh, no, it's all right. I just, you know, we're stuck between the world leaders here, and it's what I think is positive, and what a lot of people around here think is that Washington isn't directly addressing his threats to us anyway, and that I think is a positive thing. The last time a few weeks ago when we got all the national attention, you know, it was because of Washington, not Pyongyang. So I think we're kind of happy about that.
It was Washington who identified Guam as a target that last month?
No, actually, I mean, Kim Jong-un, he has identified us numerous times as a target or as a potential target. It's the reaction of Washington last time that escalated it.
Oh, yeah.
And
fire and
turned
fury.
It into a big story, you know.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned the economic impact, and, of course, you have a sizable visitor industry there. How much of the economy is visitors on Guam?
Well, it's an enormous part of our economy.
Is it?
We have about 1.5 million visitors every year, mostly from Japan and South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
This is a huge part of our economic engine. The other part is the federal government, because so much of our island is owned and controlled by the military or the federal government, that is a huge part of our economic engine as well.
Sure.
But tourism is so important to us, and we've lost, in the last month or so, about 7,500 cancellations. We've had about 7,500 cancellations, and we've lost somewhere in the neighborhood of $9.5 million from the tourist industry just since the last big threat.
Over the space of roughly 4 or 5 weeks, yeah?
Right, and now all the final numbers aren't quite in yet.
Yeah.
These are estimates from our Guam Visitors Bureau, but really, obviously, it is having an impact. And ironically, when the president talked with our governor at that time, he was very excited about all of the tourism increase we were going to have because of all the publicity that we were getting.
The president?
That has certainly not panned out.
The president thought that? President Trump thought that you were going to get a bump in tourism?
Yes, absolutely. He was very excited about it.
Well, it would be an odd reason to go visit someplace, wouldn't it?
Yes, it certainly would. It certainly would be an odd reason. But, the old saying in PR, no publicity is bad publicity. But so far, it hasn't really worked out for us in the tourism industry. But, there's a lot of flexibility in that. And next month, it could be completely different.
Well, I've always wondered about that no such thing as bad publicity line, but you're getting an opportunity to test it out. I'm just wondering what a long-term impact would be if this is not likely to stop anytime soon is the problem, Jefferson.
Oh, that is absolutely. That is a big problem, and there doesn't seem to be any end in sight to this. Certainly the saber rattling and all of that is going to continue. I don't know about the testing, but certainly the political part of it is going to continue. And yes, of course, we are directly affected by it. And it is a helpless feeling, because we have no input. We are an unincorporated territory, which is a fancy way of saying a colony.
Mm-hmm.
And are completely at the mercy of Washington. We have we can't vote for president. We have a non-voting delegate in Congress who can't really do much directly. So we're the pawn.
The situation you're facing today, Jefferson, places the Guam Visitors Bureau in a particular bind. What kind of things can they do? Obviously they've got to get out there and say, no, okay, it's okay to come here, but how can they craft a message around that?
Yeah, that's a difficult one, and they are struggling with that. I mean, our tourism numbers have risen steadily over the last couple of years until this happened.
Mm-hmm.
We were at, for months before this, we were at maximum occupancy in our hotels, and we were getting... actually, our visitors from South Korea, those numbers have been rising steadily. And usually, in the past, our Japanese visitor numbers have been the leader. And now South Korea and Japan are about the same, at least before this happened. And now the most of our drop-off is coming from the Japanese tourism.
You know, Jefferson, this really brings the impact home, doesn't it? When you read
budget-wise, you know, this is so important to us. And if it continues like this, this trend continues, we're going to be in real trouble.
Well, you know, the tendency when you read the headlines, especially when they get repetitive the way they have been in the threat back-and-forth game with North Korea, there's a tendency for the average newspaper reader to sort of have your eyes glaze over, here we go again. But it's very different when you're there on the ground, isn't it?
It sure is. And, you know, it's interesting. We got such an enormous international media response. You know, we had journalists from all over the world here, and for a few days, and poof, they're gone. And now, of course, in the national news, there's a lot of other more important things going on. I think that's a good thing. I mean, all that negative attention is not necessarily a good thing. On the other hand, you know, we are isolated, and certainly in the States, they pay very little attention to us. And so sometimes, you know, maybe that publicity helps us out a little bit in the long run. I don't know.
Jefferson, looking at your role as a non-voting member in Congress, what's the attitude toward that? I mean, do people resign to that? You know, as you say, kind of a de facto colony status. Is that resented? Is that accepted? What's the feeling on the ground there?
Well, it's interesting. I think most people. There are efforts to change our political status. Some people are advocating statehood. Some people want independence, free associated state status, that sort of thing. But I think most of the locals would rather have the status quo at this point. But the idea that we are not equal citizens under the United States umbrella, that does bother people a lot. And it's not that we get a lot of benefits from the federal government, you know, and that sort of thing. But still, because we don't have a say, we don't have any input, it is very bothersome. And our political leaders for generations have been working on this and trying to get more of a voice in Washington. But, of course, we're tiny, and that's very, very difficult. Nobody anticipates a change in political status, that's for sure.
Well, there isn't really a clear pathway toward any kind of a change in status that I can see, or is there?
No, not really. I mean, statehood isn't going to happen because we're just so small. That's certain, but and Washington isn't interested in changing status. They have complete control over us. You know, they can do anything they want here, and I think that's the way they want to keep it.
Well, that was kind of my next question. Are there some benefits to being a little bit off Washington's radar?
I think so. It's kind of funny. You know, we have one foot in Asia, one foot in the United States, and our economy is more dependent on the Asian economy than the U.S. economy. Most of our population here are Asians. So it is an interesting, I mean, it's a very interesting place to live because of this. It's not going to change. You know, as I'm fond of saying, from Washington's perspective, we're a giant military base. And as long as that base isn't under attack, they're kind of going to, you know, ignore us.
Well, Jefferson, we're not going to ignore you, and I really appreciate the opportunity to check in with you and sort of get the boot on the ground there. And as things change or even as they continue, we'll hope to check in with you from time to time. But thanks very much.
I'm happy to visit with you anytime. We love telling the Guam story, and especially to our good neighbors in Hawaii.
Well, there's quite a story to tell, Jefferson. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
Jefferson Cronin is the Morning Edition host at KPRG, Guam Public Radio, as well as a professor of communications, English, and humanities at the University of Maryland, University College Asian Division. He has lived in Guam for 23 years.
Aloha, this is Alan Oshima. You're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Hawaii is no stranger to the championship of all championships, the Olympics. Swimming, dressage, and volleyball are just a few of the sports that island athletes have excelled in. For today's quiz, we wanted to know who was the judo master who competed in the 1988 South Korea Games and almost took the top spot on the podium. Born in 1963, our mystery judoka started the martial art at the age of 7 and continued the sport while at Pearl City High School. He's a 1981 alumnus and went on to represent Team USA in the extra lightweight division in the 1988 Summer Olympics. He had memorable matchups leading to the gold medal round, including a victory over 1984 Olympic champion Shinji Hosokawa. Historians remember the final match because the referee called a one-point penalty in favor of Korea's Jae-yup Kim, which would turn out to be a controversial decision that sent Kevin Asano home with the silver. And Katsumi Takamoto, calling from Honolulu, got that right. Congratulations, Katsumi. That's our quiz for today. Thanks to Rylan Suisha for sending it in. If you've got a quiz like that for us, send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. We're back with HPR News Director Bill Dorman in the wake of our discussion with our friend on Guam, Jefferson Cronin, because it's it really does sound like a sort of a lonely, beleaguered perspective to have on that island. Briefly in the international focus, as he said, reporters came from all over the world, and then, in his words, poof, they were gone, right?
You know, Jefferson also brought up a really interesting point, I think, just sort of as he was talking about the growth of tourism before all of this Guam. And one of the huge growth areas, Japan has long been the key market, I mean, much like Hawaii, for Guam and,
a lot of
and
similarities.
Tourism in Guam. A lot of similarities in that, and interesting that South Korea has picked up as a source of tourism. The nature of sort of the economy, economic growth in South Korea, growth of the middle class, growth of more moneyed, more traveling class is something that is relatively new there. And it's interesting, I hadn't realized that Guam was one of the beneficiaries of that. This past year, for instance, more South Koreans traveled outside the country than ever before. And it's one of those longer-term dynamics that is in the region. You know, people talk about these crisis points that come up with North Korea.
Right.
and other regional conflicts, but certainly North Korea is sort of off by itself in that category. But meanwhile, South Korea itself, going along with that the trend of economic growth, also just today, the President of South Korea, Prime Minister of Japan, talking about, again, on the diplomatic cooperation and trying to get together on the sanctions front against North Korea.
It's a really good indicator of the economic health of a country. You're talking about South Korea when people start to travel abroad. That's an indication that you've got a middle class that's comfortable, disposable income. Only then do people start even thinking about having a holiday outside of the country, right?
And it's interesting. You look at some folks that track these comparative numbers, folks like the IMF, the World Bank, and track the development of countries along that scale. And that's absolutely right, because you have disposable income. You have a larger proportion of the economy being spent by reflected by consumer spending, and you have factors like outside travel, like international travel. It's interesting, you know, Guam gets overlooked a lot within sort of the Asia Pacific, but again, hopefully not just on North Korean missile launch stories, but really big piece of that.
Well, I wonder long-term if Guam can look for some sort of change in its status. It's very much off the radar now, but I wonder if any of these machinations might bring a little more attention down there.
You know, tourism and the military sounds kind of familiar to those of us in Hawaii as well.
Eerily familiar, doesn't it, Bill?
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for checking in with us again, because it's a valuable perspective.
We'll keep watching.
That's it for today, and up tomorrow, finding your way through the underbrush of the state capitol with the aid of the public access room. And historian Ray Lovell looks back at an early rail venture in Hawaii, Dillingham's Folly. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.